So, well, I'll sort of start where our young guy left off in some way, and there's some handout by you know, high-tech bells and whistles presentation here. So when you get this, go actually to the last page. I think I'm going to actually start where I was going to end the talk. But let me just say, you know, a few things by way of introduction. I mean, there's certain kind of complex technical issues about the definition of money, what we mean by money, different conceptions of world money that are in some sense being debated or at least discussed here. And without going into a lot of rather technical language about this, I think that there's a couple things to maybe understand here that are at stake. One is that, do we see money as fundamentally a store of value, right? That it's something, it's an object in some way or something that you can actually hold that stores value. So it provides a certain kind of security, which in a capitalist economy has certain functions, right? The prices may be changing. There's a lot of uncertainty, right, in market environments, et cetera. So one conception of money would be as a store of value. And another conception of money would be more of a credit-based conception of money, where money is seen more as purchasing power. So, for instance, a credit card, for instance, is not really a store of value. In the same way, for instance, a house might be a store of value. A credit card gives you purchasing power, but the minute you exercise that purchasing power, you have a debt that needs to be repaid. So these are kind of two different conceptions of money. And then there's sort of the issue of how do we understand that in the context of the global economy, where you have a lot of different currencies. Do currencies represent fundamentally stores of value? I would argue that they don't, that they represent purchasing power, and that they come into existence through credit operations, that in some sense the U.S. international position is more akin to financing purchases through a credit card than it is through financing purchases, through producing a commodity and using that commodity to buy goods from the rest of the world. So I think that that's one of the issues at stake in all this. And I think that what that leads to, at least what I want to try and emphasize some in what I'm going to say, is perhaps two different ways of thinking about how monetary relations are established or secured. So one, again, would be through a kind of a gold-based commodity standard, right? And this was what was in operation during the period of the gold standard. The classic gold standard was 1870 to 1913. And to some degree, although I would argue it was essentially fictitious, under the Bretton Woods agreements, where the dollar was in theory convertible into gold, the rest of the international monies or international currencies were convertible into the dollar at a fixed rate. The problem with the Bretton Woods, although I'm not going to get into this, is that the dollar internally within the U.S. was not linked to gold. Under the gold standard, the pound sterling had been linked to gold in certain ways. So in fact, you had this massive expansion of dollars taking place internally within the U.S. That fueled this massive expansion of dollars and credit and liquidity globally. And that was never really tethered to gold. And the minute France said, okay, look, we've accumulated all these dollars, give us gold, the game was up. So in some sense, I would argue that the world economy has not really been on a commodity standard, maybe since 1913, but certainly since 1935. So those I think, are just some of the issues that sort of the question of world money raises. Now, I think that the remarks I want to make are more in the immediate context is kind of the shifting parameters of the crisis. As we all know, from 2007 to 2009, there was this major financial global meltdown, the collapse of major banks, et cetera. There were various mechanisms that I think have been discussed a lot at past conferences, central banking, liquidity injections, guarantees by sovereign governments of the debts of banks, that essentially allowed the world economy to move through, and the U.S. to move through kind of the acute phase of the crisis. But what's happened is that there's sort of been a shift, right, where the crisis is now no longer this worry about the massive collapse of liquidity within the banks, asset write-downs, et cetera. But in some sense, the crisis has been shifted onto the public sector. And if you were reading the business press, you could sort of see Financial Times, Wall Street Journal. First, there was all this anxiety about, well, we need to intervene, we need to intervene. And there was not a whole lot of discussion about how are we going to pay for this. It was just assumed the means would be found to pay for it. Once the banks got their bailout, once sort of things returned to some semblance of normalcy, although how normal things really are right now is a question, but once the banks got their bailout, the whole discourse shifted. I mean, you could sort of see, oh, what about the deficit? Oh, what about the deficit? What, how, and you saw this shift where if all of a sudden the problem became, what are we going to do long-term to reduce the deficits that were created by the response to the crisis? And so in some, that's sort of the point I'm starting from is what is really at stake in this debate about the supposed unsustainability of the U.S. or other major sovereign governments to continue to finance the debt. And this question becomes very, very deeply imbricated within the question of the U.S. trade deficit, and the question of the U.S. external exposure, the exposure of the dollar, the role of the dollar as the fundamental international currency, international means of payment. So we often hear this story that the U.S. has this massive external deficit, that foreigners are essentially financing the ability of the U.S. government to continue to conduct certain payments to pay Social Security, et cetera, et cetera. And that the crisis, right, is that if foreigners would suddenly decide not to continue to fund the U.S. deficit, that this would create a run on the dollar, a massive liquidation of foreign-held dollar-denominated assets. The dollar would the value of the dollar would begin to plummet on the international market. This would, in turn, exacerbate the sense of a growing crisis of the dollar. It would drive up U.S. interest rates, and it would have these potentially very dangerous, negative, uncertain consequences. So this story, I would argue, the question of world money is deeply connected to the question of class power and imperial power, because the gold standard can be seen as a way in which governments and populations were essentially subjected to the disciplinary power of money. When you don't have the gold standard to sort of have certain rules that regulate the role of states in funding deficits, the ability to essentially create means of payment, you have to have other mechanisms to enforce this disciplinary power of money. And I think that this is what fundamentally the debate about the non-sustainability of the U.S. trade deficit and the non-sustainability of the U.S. fiscal deficit is about. I don't mean, let me preface this by saying I'm not dismissing the claim that there are any problems with the ability of the U.S. to, or that the U.S. can just run any level of deficit, any level of fiscal deficit or trade deficit it wants. I'm not saying that. But I would argue that, in fact, when you really begin to pick apart the issues, when you really begin to look at what is the real source of the crisis, where is the distress, what is it really about, that fundamentally it's not about technical laws of economics. It's not about that there's some ratio at which point the debt to GDP becomes unsustainable. And I would definitely argue it's not fundamentally about the U.S. trade deficit. I might, be proven wrong in the next 10 years saying this, I think that the concern about the U.S. trade deficit is vastly overblown. I think that what the U.S. is essentially doing is it's a mechanism of providing international liquidity to the market, and that as long as foreigners continue to accept dollars, this absolutely, it doesn't represent a fundamental violation of any law of credit. It doesn't represent a violation of any laws of economics. That it's fundamentally at root about securing international confidence in the ability of the U.S. to continue to perform certain managerial and custodial functions vis-a-vis the world economy as a whole. Now, you could argue that there need to be other ways of providing international liquidity. A kind of a gold standard would be a former mechanism of doing that. The Bretton Woods agreements was an attempt to kind of blend gold with state-based nominal money. But I would argue that, again, the trade deficit is not the concern that we're being told. It's not really what we need to worry about. Nor do I think we really need to worry about the issue of rising fiscal deficits, at least in the short to medium term. So with that as a bit of a preamble, Let me just, there's a couple of things that I want to try and go through. Again, some of this is a little technical, but I'm just going to try and go through it to give people a sense of some of the issues at stake. So again, one of the questions when we think about world money or the organization of the international economy today is that we have these, what we could call national monetary spaces. So the dollar constitutes a national monetary space. The yen constitutes a national monetary space. The euro is kind of an intermediate case. It's still a regional monetary space that in each case they're linked to a central bank. And in each case they're linked to taxing powers of the government. So one of the first questions we would want to ask in approaching the issue of world money and ultimately the question of these deficits, fiscal and trade deficit, is how is this national space actually constituted or composed? And the real issue here is why is it that we can use credit cards? Why is it that all these bank monies, these private bank monies, these lines of credit that different banks, Citibank, Wells Fargo, et cetera, issue, right, that we use every day, are seen as, in some sense, equivalent or homogeneous on the money market? This may seem rather obvious, but if you actually think about it, it's not. That essentially what you have is private entities, profit-making entities, that are issuing lines of credit that are creating liabilities against themselves, but in the course of doing that, those means of payment become equivalent, right? So they become interchangeable on the market. Well, the way that basically happens, to sort of gloss over a lot of complexities, is if you look at figure one in this handout I gave you. What this basically does is that there's a hierarchy of settlements that constitutes a national monetary space. So on the bottom line, there's firms and households. So these are, again, people like us, business firms that are conducting payments, making transactions. Those payments are essentially settled through the credit and financing operations of private banks. So a bank will issue a loan, it creates a liability on itself, you use that line of credit, a payment is shifted to the person receiving it, that person or that firm records a deposit at a bank, that other bank then sends a signal to the bank, to your bank, of a kind of a debt, right? So that these exchanges between households and firms are transposed into liabilities and assets, claims between banks. Now, what happens is that those claims are in turn settled through the central bank. And if a very simple explanation, this is a bit of a reduction, but a very simple explanation of what a central bank is in a contemporary monetary economy is it's a massive balance sheet. That what it does is it essentially records credits and debits between private banks. That's in bottom line, that's what a central bank is. It's a balance sheet. And I would argue that fundamentally, and this is the interesting and sort of strange thing about modern money, is that it's really just accounting entries. Very little is actually exchanged, right? It's basically just electronic signals that are recording credits and debits. This happens in a national space. This also happens at a global level, although tracing out how that takes place at a global level is very complicated. So the idea here that I want to emphasize is that, go to figure two. This is how the government finances its deficits. So in the top figure, phase one, what I have here is the Treasury Department. So the Treasury Department, for instance, will issue a check. And that check, or it will undertake a military procurement on the part of the government. There will be a household or firm that receives that payment. Now, this takes place prior to any borrowing. The Treasury and the government do not need to borrow any money in order to undertake this. So this is another mystification in some sense that takes place, is that the government needs to borrow money in order to spend. In fact, that's not true. What the government does is it spends. And the money is received by a household or firm. So for instance, if you receive a check from the government, that check is deposited into your bank, and then what happens is that the bank sends a signal to the Federal Reserve. It sends a signal to the central bank. And what the Federal Reserve does is it records a debit in the government's account and it credits the bank. So that's how the payment takes place. So it's essentially a credit operation. What the government then does, because the central bank is prohibited by law from this open financing of U.S. Debt, the Treasury will then issue a security, and that security will be sold to a domestic bank. Now, domestic banks, if you're in a closed economic system, right, if we just think of one country, a domestic bank will always use those reserves to buy that security that is issued by the government, because reserves generally don't bear interest. So a bank will decide to convert the reserves, and so the government is always able to ensure in a closed system that it's able to finance its own debt. So it can spend and then essentially borrows back the very liquidity that's created in the private banking system. So in that sense, there's no real problem for the government in a closed system financing its ability to make payments. So there's a couple things, points that I just want to draw out. One, that the government, in this sense, can auto-finance its deficits. That borrowing, and this is an important point, the government borrows not in order to spend, but in order to allow the central bank to hit its interest rate targets. If the government didn't borrow back that liquidity, what banks would do is that they would seek to invest it in various types of assets. That would drive the asset prices up, and it would actually lower the rate of interest. So what the government is doing when the Treasury borrows is it's pulling liquidity that it can create, it can pump into the private banking market, out of that market to essentially allow the Federal Reserve, if the Federal Reserve wants the interest rate to be at 2%, the government essentially assists the Federal Reserve in being able to hit that interest rate target. And this is an important point, although I'm going to kind of gloss over some of these claims, but we can discuss them later, is that most of the claims, I would argue, about the problems with deficits, why deficits are a bad thing, why we need to control deficits, are in fact not true. One of the things we hear is that deficits are inflationary. I would just make the strong claim, while inflation is a complex phenomenon, government deficits in and of themselves do not generate inflation. They are not inflationary. Another is that government borrowing depresses private investment. Again, I would kind of categorically reject. There are many complexities. There are certain circumstances under which that could be true. But in general, that does not hold. And I think the other thing that's often said is something called Ricardian equivalence, that the government basically cannot stimulate the economy because people know that if the government's running a deficit now, they're going to be taxed later. Therefore, they save more now, and that therefore the government should just run a balanced budget because it's not going to have any real effect. I think that the empirical evidence for that argument is near zero. So what is the real concern? And I'm going to kind of gloss over some things. I think the real concern about government deficits and the whole politics of money is fundamentally about the seniors' privileges of a sovereign state. The fact that the government, the Treasury, is really the sole agent that can finance its payments directly through the liabilities of the central bank. It has a kind of unique power. So if we go back to that first graph, banks operate within a private circuit that's cleared through the central bank. The government actually can finance its payments directly in those liabilities. So it has a certain ability to issue payments and to confirm its own ability to spend that is not dependent on a prior confirmation in the market. In the sense that a private credit is a kind of an anticipatory pre-confirmation of the social character of private labor. The government's payments are, in one sense, already socially pre-confirmed, in the sense that the government can impose taxes, that it can declare what constitutes legal tender, and again, that it issues payments and conducts its transactions directly in the liabilities of the central bank. When we move to an open economy, the issues become a little bit different because the Treasury and the government doesn't have taxing power. The U.S. government cannot determine what constitutes legal tender on the international market. So the U.S. cannot determine or require foreigners to hold and transact in dollars. So to gloss over a series of points I was going to try and draw, but I think I'm running a little bit short of time. But The question then fundamentally becomes, if the government doesn't have compulsory powers, you could show in a closed system the U.S. government or any sovereign government can impose any level of debt it wants in a closed system because of these powers, these taxing powers, the power to declare legal tender, the role of the bank, the fact that banks will always use reserves to buy the debt of the U.S. government. These considerations don't apply in quite the same way at the international market. So the question becomes securing the confidence of foreigners to continue to hold dollars and to use those dollars in certain circumstances, or at least some of those dollars, to buy the debt of the U.S. government. The article I wrote in Socialist Register, the most recent, it talks about these things in some length, so I can't explicate all the issues. But what I would say is this. I would say that there is, to some degree, a compulsory aspect of foreigners holding dollars, at least at the current time, that's related to the role of U.S. trade deficits in the provision of international liquidity. So there is, you could argue that, in fact, there is more compulsion, that the U.S. is to some degree able to impose its debt and impose its trade deficits on the rest of the world. Obviously, some of that is the role of the U.S. consumer as a market of first and last resort, etc. So there are these, and some of it is also the role of the dollar in the provision of international liquidity. I would argue, however, more fundamentally, that it's that the role of the dollar expresses a kind of confidence that when, essentially what the U.S. is doing, in my opinion, is that the U.S. is essentially engaged in a kind of a pre-confirmation of the entire world market. You saw in this crisis that everyone fled into the dollar, even though the epicenter of the crisis was right here in the U.S. All capital looked to the U.S. And what the U.S. does, you can see it in moments of crisis. You can't see it as well during normal periods. But you can see that the central bank and the U.S. Treasury were essentially guaranteeing, they were underwriting the entire world market. And that is essentially the role of the dollar, and it's essentially the basis of the confidence international investors put in the U.S. So to go back to this graph, I find this interesting, this graph on, this is gold prices deflation, I'm wrapping up here. But you can almost see this as an index of anxiety, an index of global anxiety. Now, there are going to be speculative aspects affecting gold, but when you look at this is a very long index of gold price deflated by the U.S. CPI. And you can see that gold is fairly stable in its price during the period of the gold standard, international metallic commodity standard, that it shoots up with the breakdown of the Bretton Woods agreements, and it shoots up, it goes to this very high peak that ends around the time of Volcker, Reagan, and the kind of the shift towards neoliberalism. Now, one point I want to make, and I'll conclude with this, and we can take most stuff up in the discussion, is that if this is an index of confidence, notice that global confidence in the dollar is being restored at the very time that, if you look at the prior page, the U.S. trade deficit is going through the roof. The U.S. fiscal deficit is going through the roof. Now, you could say this is a temporary phenomenon, but you could also argue that fundamentally that international confidence in the dollar is not about the trade deficit, it's not about the fiscal deficit, it's about a kind of a confidence in the ability to perform certain custodial capacities. We see that this index is going up again, so there appears to be growing international concern about the ability of the U.S., not so much the dollar, the ability of the U.S. to provide certain kinds of custodial, steering, governance capacities to the world economy as a whole. So there's a lot more that I want to say about this. I'm out of time, so we'll take more stuff up in the discussion.
Thanks.